time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 27th of October. Island Life is our weekly magazine show, brought to you every Saturday from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 27th of October 2012, Sharon Brown talked to Paul Walden from the local board and two of the candidates for the Auckland Youth Advisory Council. And she spoke to molecular genetic scientist David Saul about genetically modified organisms in the Hauraki Gulf.
We've got Bella and Nicolasi, who are standing for the, what's it called exactly? The
Youth Advisory Panel.
The Youth Advisory Panel. Great. Good. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Okay. Hi. You need to talk on that one, Nicolasi, because it's the only one working. And hi, Paul.
Hello.
So we've also got Paul Walden here. So Paul, can you just introduce this whole thing to us? It's a Youth Advisory Panel Council?
Yes, that's right.
So can you explain what it all is?
Yeah, essentially the Mayor has decided that the number one priority for Auckland Council is our young people. I think that's wonderful. And a part and parcel with that, he really wants to listen to young people, and so he's set up a Youth Advisory Panel, which has one representative from every local board across the region. And they sit down with the Mayor and or one of the other councillors and a group of officers and work through, getting feedback from young people on the issues that the council's facing.
Okay, so is this a new initiative?
Well, it's... I wouldn't suggest it's a new initiative. The...
it's all going on here, yeah.
The, various councils previously have had youth councils and youth advisory panels under various different forms. And so the Auckland Council has had one up and running. And this is the first time that the Waiheke local board's had a representative.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
Oh, well, I think, like many things with Waiheke, we're a little bit outside, the easy things to solve.
Right, okay.
And so it has taken a bit of a push, and there's been a wonderful team of people involved with WICOS and also a officer at the council, Alf, who's been quite passionate about getting this up and running for Waiheke. So, yeah.
Great, lovely. Okay, so we've got two of the candidates, so Nicolasi and Bella. So, hi guys. So, what is it that suddenly made you think, well, that you'd like to stand for this? Okay, they're both pointing at each other, but it's okay. Hopefully we'll get this sorted in the next few minutes. Nicolasi, why did you think it would be a nice thing to do? You need to get right in on top of the mic. There we go. Yeah, there we go. Good job.
I don't know. I just felt like I want to do something good.
Okay.
For Waiheke, because I've been brought up here like all my life. So yeah, maybe just try represent Waiheke for something good.
Lovely. Possibly. Great. And Bella, what inspired you to take part in this? Yep, your turn. Oh, slight blank moment. What kinds of projects are you involved with in school? Are there certain things that you do at school? What are your interests at school?
I will help out here.
Okay, go on then.
A little bit. And having read through the nomination forms for all five candidates, and I'll just point out actually that there's one candidate, Tahoa, whose nomination form seems to have got lost in the post.
Oh.
So there may be six candidates yet.
Oh, right. Okay.
But it's actually really exciting to see this group of young people just really passionate about giving something back to the community and wanting to be involved. And there's just a clear recognition that there's not good representation on our local board and, across the council of the aspirations of young people. And, this is something that I've been really passionate about solving because I just see the education. We've got this wonderful education system and such smart, intelligent people, young people in our community that haven't been corrupted by the rigours of life.
Mm. And I think it's quite a nice way of getting young people more involved with the political systems around them. Because, I mean, whether you like it or not, you're... the politics under which you live also influence the some of the choices you have. So it's actually quite good to get involved with that young and see how it works. And I think it's a huge opportunity.
Oh, look, absolutely. I think it would just be really exciting at next year's local board election to see, you know, someone under 25 in our community getting on the local board.
Mm.
And that's the really exciting thing I can see coming out of this process, is it's actually going to, you know, really engage young people in the community with their ability to have a vote and have a say.
Mm.
And we just need to keep that going.
Great. So a couple more questions for you guys then. So, because you did answer some questions already, I'm not sure where they are up on, I know they're up on Paul Walden's Facebook page, but they might be up in other places. Is there some?
Yeah, they're also on the Parliament page and the Community Notice Board. So.
Oh, okay, fine. So those are all Facebook pages. And have you got a brief up on Auckland Council somewhere? Do you know if you wrote something that's appeared on a website somewhere or not really?
No, it's not on a website yet.
Okay, fine. So it might be put up.
So there will be some papers distributed next week to the students at the school.
Okay. Yep. So then I guess what I'd like to ask you is, what do you love about living on Waiheke?
The people.
How close everyone is. Like, everyone knows everyone and stuff, and, like, yeah.
Okay, lovely, good. And so what do you think are some of the challenges faced by young people on the island? Or young people generally?
How young some teens are starting drinking and smoking and stuff.
Right, okay. So the drinking and the smoking is maybe a problem, yeah? Great.
Yep.
Nicolasi, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I reckon that too much young people in Waikato drink.
Mm. Okay, great. And what do you, if you could change anything in the community, what would you like to change?
Stop drinking for teenagers and smoking cannabis.
Right. Okay.
That's
allowed. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it would be silly to deny that people smoke. Yeah. And Bella, what about yourself? What do you reckon?
The prices of the ferry, or the prices of the ferries, how they're going, the prices are going up and it's getting more expensive. Should be more cheaper.
Right, lovely. And can you guys benefit from student fares?
Yep.
Yeah.
You can? Okay, lovely. But you think that maybe they should be a bit cheaper?
Yep.
Right, okay, good. Lovely. And what else? And any thoughts on why you should be the person who's chosen to represent your community?
Because I've grown up here and I have an understanding of this community, and I know a lot of the people, and like I've grown up with most of the teens and the children and stuff, and yeah.
Lovely. Nicolasi?
What was the question?
Why do you think the other youth should pick you? Why not?
Yeah, probably.
Good. Okay, lovely. Okay, you guys are doing a fabulous job. It's so great that you've come into radio and to talk a little bit about yourselves. And good. So, Paul, can I just ask you, what's the process? How do people get elected?
Okay, so we're having a voting day next Friday. So there'll be a polling booth at the high school. And also, and so there'll be some sort of event run with that. I think the council's going to put on a sausage sizzle. Also, there'll be a polling station at the Matete Ferry Terminal to capture anyone that's coming back from town. And also, we're looking at having something outside Placemakers or Woolworths, and possibly having an opportunity to capture the votes of the students at the intermediate school at Waiheke Primary.
Right. Okay. Great. So how old do you have to be to vote?
Yeah. So the age range is from 12 to 24. And I was thinking about this last night. A wonderful opportunity if you're aged between 18 and 24, you get to vote twice. i.e., you know, in the local board elections, yeah, and here for a youth representative.
Right. Yeah. But is that fair? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, of course, yeah, it's of course
just,
it's fair.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
But we should talk about these other candidates as well, and I don't know if I've introduced all of them yet.
Yes. But would you like to introduce them or say something about them?
I'll just scroll through quickly. We've got Bella, who's here.
Yeah.
She's a student at Waiheke High School. And then we have Nicolasi, who's also a student at the high school.
And is also here.
And is also here. We've got Denise Roche's daughter, Matariki, who's a high school student. Now, some of these students can't be here today. They've been away on a school camp.
Yes.
So I'm not actually sure whether they're back on the island yet or not. But they've had a wonderful time, I believe, exploring Tongariro track.
Mm. And I think that applies to Tatiana Timmins-Scanlon and Matariki. They're both on the school camp.
So I believe. Yeah. And then we've got Troy Lomas, who's at AUT. He's doing a bachelor's degree in sports and recreation. So he's involved with the sports clubs and, you know, various groups through the community.
Yes, and I think he used to work at the rec centre as before he went off to AUT.
Yeah.
He used to be one of the staff at the rec centre for the holiday program and the after school program.
Wonderful. So what have you got on your...
Well, I'm just looking at it here. So I just thought, because, I mean, the thing is, all candidates were invited to come in this morning.
Yeah.
But because everyone's got different commitments, and I think especially young people have different commitments, it was hard to get everyone to come in.
Yeah, totally.
So that's why we've asked questions. All the answers to all these questions are up on the... up on these Facebook pages at the moment, and there might be something coming up on the council soon. But in any case, so other responses that we've had...
I love Tatiana's response here when she's asked what would she like to change.
Yep.
And she's fired back a quick fire response, and starting with the local board.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. And what about Matariki? It's hard to work out where we are on here. Hang on. What does Matariki say? If we can... what would she like?
But there's some wonderful stuff here. I mean, these guys are just so engaged with community issues. You know, Tatiana talking about you know, better school resources, roading infrastructure, recreational facilities, lots of stuff for kids and families.
Mm. And Matariki's got here, if you could change anything in your community, I'd like there to be a youth space where we can hang out and have fun.
Yeah.
I'd also like it if the community felt safe and well represented it with intelligent, diverse local decision makers who encourage debate and active participation across the board. Also, having a youth board will be great as it creates more diverse groups of young people for the youth representatives to fall back on. Troy, in answer to the same question, if you could change... Oh, here we... give youth a voice on Waiheke. This is what Troy Lomas would like to change. Give youth on Waiheke a voice. Provide more activities and opportunities for Waiheke youth. Raise Waiheke leaders and change the ways of old.
Mm, great stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's quite inspiring, isn't it? Who haven't we heard from?
We haven't heard a lot about Mata.
Yeah, we have. I've just... Matariki. Is that who you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what she was saying.
Okay.
And do you guys feel that you want to have another stab at that? Have you already put it on here?
Yeah.
Pretty sure. Drinking and smoking, that's your initiative? Yeah, great. Now, I know there was... Now, the thing is, I mean, Waiheke is quite a diverse community, and that's one person that can go forward to Auckland. But... at the same time, there are lots of issues that maybe youth could tackle on Waiheke. And once you've gone through this whole process of getting everyone to stand for election and raising the profile of youth and youth needs and showing an interest in maybe what youth would like, would you guys consider having some sort of local group that deals with Waiheke issues, and maybe all the kids who've stood can actually be on that local group?
Yes, that's what we were talking about before in the car driving here.
Ah, okay.
All six of us work together as a group to, like, encourage young people to vote.
Great.
So I know something about the statistics. Shows that, like, only, like, older people vote, but not, like, teenagers.
Maybe. Right.
don't
know. So it would be a nice opportunity to get some different people voting.
Yeah.
And Bella, what were your thoughts on that? Is that something you'd like to take part in?
Yep, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Lovely. And Paul, is that possible? Because all of these things depend on funding. I mean, if you did have a local group meeting, can that be facilitated in some way by the local board?
Whether or not it's done through the local board is, a good question. I think, regardless of how it happens, I think it's really important that it happens. And, I don't see funding being a huge issue. I think, one of our greatest gifts is our voice and our ability to have a say, and I think it's really important that we empower young people to be able to do that. And through whatever mechanism that is, I don't even think we need any sort of formal institution, and I just love to see this group of guys sitting around talking through and seeing, how that they can give back to their community.
Mm-hmm.
And, just when you read through, their profiles and what they're passionate about, all of these people are just wanting to give.
Mm.
And, it actually brought a tear to my eye, guys, reading through them and just reading these guys talking about how much they love their communities. And I just think it's... we've just got to capture that.
Magic, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's a whole... I mean, I've been doing a bit of work on this, and there's a whole host of different ways. Some local boards have said, we don't just want a youth representative, we want to hold youth council. So Takapuna Devonport, they've got a youth council.
Oh, really?
And out of that, they have a representative that goes off to this youth advisory panel.
Mm.
And other boards out in South Auckland and Manurewa, they've... there's a separate body which meets. It's an incorporated society. There's other groups around the country where it's just a group of people getting together, having a chat, and it might be that they have an interest in council affairs. It might not be. They might just organise an event or a series of community events or help with working bees or whatever else. But, the world's the oyster, but I think it's just really important for Waiheke that we capture this enthusiasm.
Mm. No, absolutely terrific. Now, listen, the person we haven't spoken about is Te Hau.
Yes.
And we haven't got anything on him. I mean, I know him a little bit. He's younger than everyone else, isn't he? How old is he? He looks like he's about 12.
Seven?
Year seven. What? How old are year seven kids? Are they about 12? I don't
12.
Know.
Yeah,
about 12. 12. Right, so he's really that pushing that lower boundary, isn't he?
So but how old are you, Bella?
I'm 15.
Right.
That's year what?
Year 10.
Okay.
Year 10.
And Nicolasi, what year are you in?
Year 12.
Right, okay, excellent, lovely.
So Te Hau, of course, is often seen down at the Austin Market with Denise.
Yes, and I thought what was so interesting about him is he's actually posting on an adult Facebook page. I thought that was very cool, I can't remember what would he say? I think he posted something like, what would you like changed in your community? But it was quite interesting because all these adults are.
Well, I thought that was some very clever politicking there from Te Hau. So as soon as he saw the nomination for me, read through the questions and he picked one out and threw it out for some community canvassing. So.
Yeah. Well, excellent. So, lovely. Okay. Well, listen, all the very best to you. Are you going to be making speeches at the school, or have you got some sort of campaign going, or have you got
thinking
some sort of approach?
Thinking of maybe doing it on Wednesday at the prefect assembly, but yeah.
Okay, lovely, good. And are you both prefects? Are you prefects at all?
Oh, no, those are year 13s.
Oh, okay, right, okay. Oh, well, that would be quite intimidating. Exciting?
Yep.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, listen, all the very best to you. Thanks, Paul, for coming in and talking about the Youth Council. And thanks, guys, for coming in and sharing your ideas on what you'd like for Waiheke. And have a lovely weekend.
Thanks.
Okay,
see you
great.
Too.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
We've got David Saul, and David Saul's a scientist. What kind of science do you do, David?
Molecular genetics. So
oh, okay. So
and forensics.
Right. You probably need to get in slightly closer to the mic, and then you'll be sweet. Okay. Sorry, you might want to say that again as well. I'm not sure if it came up.
Molecular genetics, forensics... Microbiology.
Okay, lovely. I don't think I can hear you. I can't hear either of us talking, actually, which is a bit... Hello?
Hello.
Maybe it's on the headphones. Okay, that seems to be a bit better. Okay. God, it's a mystery. Okay, fine. So, Lovely. So have you worked with G organisms?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've done it for about 30 years now. So I started in around 1978, so really since the whole technology took off.
Right. Okay, lovely. And so how do they work then?
It's a big question. Well, a lot of people sort of have ideas about genetic engineering. They sort of define them by extreme examples. So if you ask most people what a genetic engineered organism is, they'd say toad genes in potatoes or something like that. But in actual fact, genetic engineering is a suite of tools. It's like a toolbox. It's the equivalent of what the builders got for when power tools were introduced. It suddenly allowed biologists to make some quite radical changes, but also do a lot of the same things they were doing before, a lot more faster and a lot more efficiently. And I think that's why I have some problems with legislation that...
Okay, so can you give us an example of things that they've, you know, in a positive way, that it has allowed things to happen faster or better?
Oh, well, I mean, now we get many... there are about 36 different pharmaceuticals that are produced by genetic engineering, so if you have a child that has haemophilia and needs factor 8, you won't have another example of Yves Van Graaff horse, where you can get contaminated products. It's no longer made from blood. It's now made from a bacillus or from a yeast, so it's a cloned human gene put into a bacterium. And it's the same with growth hormone. If a child needs growth hormone, it'll come now from a GE organism rather than from the brains of cadavers. So.
Right, okay. So obviously in the pharmaceutical industry, that's proved to be quite useful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
However, I think a lot of people are primarily concerned with the release of GMOs into food and soil, which is a really different proposition, because then you've got things that can potentially grow and are not naturally occurring.
Yep, that's absolutely true. One thing that needs to be made clear is that the dissent between what is effectively the molecular scientists and the various lobby groups, such as Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, GE Free New Zealand, is not about GE. It's about that small set of organisms, the field release of crops. It's about foods and so on. And that accounts for less than 1% of the total amount of GE that goes on in the world. So we actually agree on 99% of the issue.
Right,
it's just that 1%. Now, I can fully understand the concerns, but what I would argue quite strongly is that you can't define the outcome of a particular experiment by the tools that you use, and that's what our current legislation is trying to do. It doesn't actually look at the end product, which is what the Royal Commission and other august bodies have tried to do. It actually looks at the strategy that was used to get the gene in. So if I use a genetic engineering technique to insert a gene into an organism, it gets banned. But if I manage to get that gene into the organism by other means, I don't even have to tell you about it, and it can go straight in our food. So that's where I would argue that our legislation fails. There's a lot of things that can get through the net, because our net has become rather too focused. We've become blinkered on one technology.
Right, I see. But these other ways of getting things into the plant, they also involve some sort of genetic modification of the plant.
They do indeed, but they're not genetic engineering.
Right, but if they involve genetic modification of the plant, then are you saying that they are genetic engineering, but we just don't recognise them as such?
Well, some of the techniques, for instance, let's look at mutagenesis, for example. So if I wanted to change the genes within an organism, one way in which I could do it is to treat the genes with chemical mutagens or to radiation, expose them to X-rays. And that's been done since about 1927, 1928. And if you look on various databases, there's one database which has the unusual bed partners of the Atomic Energy Authority and the World Food Organization of the United Nations. So the two will work together. You'll actually find that every single plant and crop that we eat has at least one ancestor that has been treated to mutagenesis. So to give you an example of a real-life example, most people don't like the Roundup Ready crops that are produced by Monsanto, and the primary reason they wouldn't like those crops nearby them is that it allows the widespread spraying of a herbicide, Roundup, onto the fields, the spray drift, there's the fact that your food is getting coated with a large amount of agrochemical.
And I think the other issue is that you're putting the pesticide genetically in, you're modifying it so that it has pesticide within the plant.
Well, not in the case of Roundup Ready. That's just it just has a gene in it which makes it resistant to a pesticide, so there's no pesticide within.
Right, okay. But there are other ones that do have the pesticide put in, like the Bayer rice crop.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. But if we go back to the Roundup Ready, most people are against the Roundup Ready because it allows widespread spraying. Now, there's another company, the European...
Can I just say, it's not just that either. It's also the fact that it's been modified in a way that makes it Roundup Ready, and there are a lot of studies that show that maybe if you genetically modify stuff, you can't guarantee the kinds of health issues, allergies, etc., that come up from it.
Oh, okay.
And the other thing around it is it's also about open field trials, and not enough open field trials and not enough longitudinal studies are done before this is released on the public.
Okay, I mean, I'm not denying any of that, but what I'm saying is that there is another crop put out by Syngenta, the European company, which is resistant to its own herbicide, which is called tetrazine, which has a higher ecotoxicity than Roundup. And studies have shown that the gene conferring that particular resistance have been spread because it's in canola. It's a wind-pollinated plant, and they've been found several kilometres away. Now, I would have thought that if you were concerned about that type of thing, you would have legislated against both. But because the Syngenta crop was created by non-GE methods, the gene was put in a different manner, then it gets round the legislation. It doesn't have to be regulated.
Mm. And so that's a huge concern as well, isn't it?
It's a huge concern, but I believe that that is down to the fact that our legislation is focused on the technology of manufacture, and it's not focused on the end product. I'm actually more conservative than most. I would like a legislation that looks at every single crop and says, well, if this has an undesirable gene, then it shouldn't be out there, and I don't really mind how that gene got in.
Mm, absolutely, and I think that's a really valid point, which is probably not really addressed sufficiently. I mean, the other issue which is causing concern, and the reason this is all sort of jumping around at the moment, is that... under the old Auckland Council, Auckland City Council, and the old Auckland Regional Council, there were a number of policy statements around GMOs, and there were a lot of submissions, and individual districts and boards had statements around that. Now, in the Auckland Council policy document, all of those things have been taken away, and the only remaining reference to GMOs was in the Hauraki Island Gulf District plan. And apparently in 2009, that line was also crossed out, that reference to GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the concern is that Auckland has no protection against GMOs in their local policy documents.
It does have protection, though, under the Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, which is national policy. My only concern about that, and I agree with you entirely, I hate the idea that local bureaucrats and local leaders can, in an underhand way, take away a piece of legislation or take away some regulation which is looked upon as beneficial, and it's very popular. I'm totally against that. My one concern is, perhaps I'm overly suspicious, but I fear that it's a red herring, so that they can cave in on that one and make everybody happy while slipping something else under the net. You know, something to do with development.
So I think it's a different an approach then, because for me it seems that all the local boards should have quite strong statements, and when lots of people submit against GMOs, it's interesting that when you update the policy from Auckland City Council to Auckland Council, suddenly all of those policies disappear when 60 to 80% of people are concerned that they want A, food to be labelled as GMO, and B, don't really want GMO substances in the food chain.
Yeah, I can see that. I've no problem with legislation. What I would like to What I would like to sort of add to the mix, though, is that I like the public to have a choice, but I like it also to be an informed choice. And we've not had a lot of information about what this technology is. I did a lot of public outreach for the university in a non-partisan way. I was doing talks to various groups all the way from Rotary to GE Free New Zealand to conventions that they'd put together. And the most striking thing about it that I found was that I could go into a room full of people with 200 people who all hated GMOs and generally all hated me when I walked in the room, and not one of them could actually tell me what it is. They had some sort of nebulous notion of, or a few extreme examples. And because we've defined it by extreme examples, we don't realise that there is a lot of overlap between a lot of existing technologies. So,
yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. Having said that, I think the problem is there's a lot of misinformation that gets out there, and also striking things out of policy documents so they are no longer in policy documents and therefore aren't addressed and therefore can't be detected and can't be seen and can't be discussed. That, to me, is fundamentally wrong. I mean, I think the point is that people don't understand them necessarily, how they work, but they're concerned enough to feel that there have been so many problems with them released into food and soil that they shouldn't necessarily that they need to be regulated really severely, and they shouldn't be allowed to just be released into field without proper testing. Yeah.
Well, I can understand your concerns, but I get back to the idea, the fact that we put other things in the field without any testing. We have no regulatory structure.
And I think that's the point around food and farming generally, that a lot of it needs to be a lot more closely regulated than it is. Because I think a lot of people would like to know a lot more about the food that they're eating, and we're not given that opportunity.
But haven't we also created a situation where we spread so much fear on one side that we've created the opinion that the corollary is true? So we've created the opinion that genetic engineered crops are unnatural, but natural is safe, and natural is far from safe. You know, what the top 100 toxins in the world are all natural.
I think there's a difference, though, between a natural toxin and a GE toxin.
Is there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just in terms of farming, I mean, I don't know, you will know more about this, so I defer to you. But nonetheless, if you can, I mean, what concerns me is that there's a confluence between the people who make the pharmaceuticals, the people who the seven companies that have the vast majority of the seed are also the pharmaceutical, are also the ones who sell the pharmaceuticals, are also the ones that make the pesticides. So there's it seems to me that there's an unhealthy and unholy relationship, that all of those groups are working one and the same group.
Yes, I understand that, but is the best way to attack those organisations by attacking a technology? I would have thought that...
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying about the technology, but I think there are other issues beyond the technology around releasing this into the environment. And if you look at things like the, what have I got here? So an experiment that went wrong by Bayer, which resulted in $1.2 billion worth of damages to the rice industry in the States when one strain entered global rice supplies in 2006. Okay. Or just generally making pesticide a part of the plant, or running the risk. I mean, now you've got superweeds that can't, that are cross-pollinating or whatever with the plants that are there, and are also potentially resulting in the end of bees. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that's exacerbated by GE, I think.
Well, there's a lot of things you've stated in that, but a lot of those things have very dubious evidence. And one of the things that I would, again, argue very strongly is that if one GE crop fails, it doesn't mean that they're all bad. They're all different. And this is the way that GE Free New Zealand argue it. They will look desperately for one crop to fail, and then they'll say the whole technology is bad. Now, if we took that...
If we
took that to the other extreme, I can name crops that were done by traditional breeding that have failed. We've created a toxic potato, one spud that would kill a family. We've created hyperallergenic celery. Now, if we took the same... way of treating it, we would then claim that all traditional crop breeding is dangerous. Well, it is. They're all dangerous. Everything has a hazard. We need to be looking things in a broader manner and not become fixated on how the gene got in. If I can put it in a different way, I get round everything that you're saying, and I can still create those problems that you're concerned
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely, and I'm saying that those are very serious problems and also need to be addressed. Yeah. But nonetheless, I think that a lot of the, you know, that stuff, I mean, there are lots of problems now with the Roundup Ready wheat, what was it called, the magic rice or something, whatever it was.
What's the problems with the Roundup Ready wheat?
Isn't it having like super weed issues?
But then again, if you don't like Roundup, isn't that a good thing?
Well, not really, because if you have to spray more pesticide on the ground so that you can protect yourself because the plants that are Roundup Ready are becoming stronger, then you're actually bringing more pesticides into the
which actually
plays into the hands of the companies that are making this stuff anyway, because their objective is to sell more pesticide.
But eventually the Roundup will no longer be of any use, so it's a disadvantage to the company. And that will happen regardless of how that crop is pesticide resistance. The problem of pesticide or herbicide resistance is not coming through the specific crop. It's coming through the way in which we farm, the monoculture mentality. There are 101 other reasons.
Absolutely, and I think that's the other issue that needs to be addressed, that monocultures aren't helping us, that the Green Revolution wasn't necessarily a success, that millions more people are in poverty now as a result of the Green Revolution that weren't helped by it. And if farmers had just been left alone to get on with their subsistence farming, the levels of poverty wouldn't necessarily be as high as they are now in many parts of the world.
Well, I'd be very interested to see if you had any evidence for that, because that's quite an extraordinary
statement. Well, I mean,
you know, we've got a population now that is twice as big as it was 100 years ago, and we're feeding twice as many people on half as much land. So, you know, for all of the faults of the Green Revolution, and God knows it's done a lot wrong, we are feeding a lot of people. We can't just throw into it that if we were all still subsistence farmers, we'd be all happy and well. We wouldn't be.
Well, for a start, I mean, if you're feeding, you know, the issues are also around population movement from farms into cities. And there's a lot of reports that have been shown to say that, you know, maybe the Green Revolution hasn't been of any benefit to anyone. And if the North had just stayed where they were and not interfered, the difference in the quality of life between rich and poor people in these societies would be, you know, more even. And maybe fewer people would have been born or whatever. And maybe the world, I mean, a lot of people think that oil is responsible for the global explosion in population as well.
Well, you can argue a lot of things, but you know, back on the issue of genetic engineering, it's just a single. I can't argue with you about global populations. I believe that you know, the cure to most of our problems is birth control, but you know, I think
anyway.
We're sort of off topic.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I did want to ask you something else that you might have be able to clarify for me. What is a nature-identical flavour? I mean, it seems to me that you either have artificial flavours, and now I notice that there's something called nature-identical flavours. Do you know what that is?
Haven't got a clue.
You haven't got a clue? Oh, okay. No, I just thought you might know. No idea at all?
No idea.
Okay. Because I mean, it must be some other category I just thought I'd ask you because I thought you might have some notion, because I'm quite puzzled by that whole concept. Either it's artificial or it's natural or it's nature identical, apparently.
But do you believe that natural makes it better?
I think there's less risk involved with natural things. I also have one of the things that really concerns me is this unholy relationship between pharmaceuticals pesticide companies and people who are copywriting seed and creating seed, that there's a really unholy synergy between all of those different things. I also don't understand why if 60 to 80% of people in New Zealand want their food to be labelled as GE free or not, or GE content to be labelled in food, why we seem so unable to prevail on our government to do that. I also wonder why, when there are policy statements that people have submitted on year after year after year after year, when Auckland City Council changes to Auckland Council, why all those policy documents have now got no reference to GMOs. And I think we leave ourselves really vulnerable. And I totally take your point that there are other farming practices, there are other issues at stake technologically. But nonetheless, if we're really honest about the risks of GMOs, then it shouldn't just be, you know, crossed off policy documents by officers without any consultation. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue that we're facing now.
Yeah, I was going to pick you up on. One of the things I was going to pick you up on was the idea of GMO labelling, labelling foods with GMO. I think we've got problems there with our legislation as well, yeah. And it came to a head with the Corngate affair. In the legislation states that we have an upper level of zero. And when you've got an upper level of zero that is acceptable...
I don't understand what that means.
Well, that means there has to be no GMO content on it. So there's no acceptable threshold. And the problem is that there are no testing strategies to actually get it down to zero. You simply can't do it. And in the case of, the Corngate scare or on contamination, we have always got to accept that the detection strategies will only get down to a certain percentage. And if you push them too far, you push those testing methods too far, you start to get a lot of false positives. So we've got problems with our legislation then. But as soon as you start telling people, well, we're going to have a lower threshold, that makes them angry too.
I think what makes me angry is the fact that this stuff has been allowed to get into the food chain somehow, so that you're telling me that we can't say that and maybe you can explain this. Why is it not possible to say that these substances that are going into our food, possibly have GMO content?
Because I think the only way around for many food manufacturers is to actually just put "may have GMO content" on everything. I was at the conference that was when the legislation was first introduced. Now was sitting on the same table as the gentleman from Tip Top Bread, and he was quietly blanching as they were saying that they were going to insist on tracing the foodstuffs that go into all of his breads. And he said just on his current bread alone, he got his currants, his sultanas, from about 50 different Turkish farmers. Now, according to the legislation that states zero, if that farmer had used the same truck as somebody else that had carried a GMO crop, then it would have to be GMO tested. So it was an impossibility. Because these crops are very widespread around the world, they're absolutely everywhere.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of the point that I think we're making, is that they are everywhere. And so consequently, it's easier for farmers or federated farmers to say, look, you know, we just don't want a GMO policy because it just makes things too complicated. You can't detect whether you've got stuff that's GMO or not. So let's just all forget about it. And my point is that what are they so scared about? So label your Tip Top Bread as containing traces of GMO or whatever, and then give me the choice to say, well, guess what? Tip Top Bread has traces of GMO. Here's this other bread that doesn't. And so I would prefer to eat the other bread. And every time I buy the Tip Top Bread, maybe because it's cheaper or because it's available or whatever, I'll then be saying, okay, well, I'm making a choice in this way, but if I have a little bit more money, or if I'm near a shop which sells another kind of bread, I'd prefer to buy that.
I can understand what you're saying, but at the same time, aren't you forcing Tip Top Bread to lose its place in the market when it has no control over what it's got in there? I mean, eventually what may happen is that every single manufacturer that gets any goods from overseas will just have to put may contain GMOs in it, and eventually everything on your shelf will have that, so we'll have yet another meaningless situation.
Yeah, but the biggest advocates against GMOs in New Zealand, well, some of them are actually food producers and suppliers. So for example, Lisa from Lisa's Hummus is a very strong advocate against GE, as is Jesse Chalmers, who's in Tonzu. I think Tonzu is it, what do you call it, that soybean product, you know, tofu.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think if the public don't want GE, then the producers need to be thinking about that. And they also need to be putting pressure on their suppliers to stay GE-free. And that's the problem, not just sort of saying, oh, well, it's not possible to legislate, it's not possible to control what we get from our suppliers. Suppliers do what the public want. I mean, suppliers do what retailers or food producers want. So it needs to be, I think, driven by the public, putting pressure on the food, on the food choices they make by the things that they choose, and thereby putting pressure on the producers.
Yeah, but I would like a public that's making those choices to be making those choices for reasons that haven't just been, that isn't hyperbole that's been put out by GE Free New Zealand or others. So we have a situation where Monsanto are a PR agent that is going out and saying that this is going to save the world from hunger, and then we've got GE Free New Zealand going out and saying this will give you cancer, this will kill your chickens, this will make the sky fall, and one's shooting 100 yards to the left of the target, another to the 100 yards to the right, and the truth, which lies somewhere in the middle, is not touched upon. So the public are forcing upon manufacturers a whole set of changes, some of them that are very expensive changes, on information that is flawed.
Mm. And to be honest, I think the seed companies need to take a bit of responsibility for that, because if you've got a PR machine that's pouring billions of dollars into something, then, you know, maybe you could spend a few less dollars doing that and a few more thinking about what the public wants. Now, obviously, GE is something where money can be made, and I think the companies see that, because subsistence farming, where people save their own seed, plant it, maintain the earth, you know, by planting a variety of crops, isn't making lots of money for anyone. Whereas pushing a GE technology and planting and then selling heaps of pesticide to people and then copywriting seeds, there's lots and lots of money in that. So there's a huge imbalance in power in the way all of this is
Understood, but is it our right in the well-fed, rich, overweight West to be telling developing nations what technologies they can have and what they can't have?
Well, in fact, when you talk to most subsistence farmers, the studies that have done have said that, you know, that they'd be better off. There's nothing to suggest that GE has necessarily been of any benefit to them at all.
Well, I would
counter
that.
And there's a lot to suggest that, you know, they'd have been better off just being left alone. And a lot of them are not happy with the stuff that's being foisted on them. Yeah. So it's really interesting to think about whose interests are being met with the push to GE.
So where have you got this information from?
Oh, okay. Well, look, let me just dig this out here. Okay, here we've got the IAASTD report from 2008, had 400 experts and government research institutes. 57 countries have approved the findings of it, and they're saying that they don't reject GE outright, but there are too many problems with it. It's not regulated enough. Local knowledge is less risky and potentially more valuable. And so they're not saying that they're outright against GE, uh-huh, but they're saying that the problems generated from it and the, you know, haven't justified the, you know, expenses spent on it and the problems it's caused us.
Well, I'd love to read that report. I also had the other report, which I posted to you a while ago, the bioethics report by the Nuffield Foundation, which is an independent, well-respected report. And again, it got round to this question of it was assessing that what we often try to do is we measure the safety and the problems of a technology without looking at the context in which it is introduced. So there may be safety aspects of a new crop that comes into Africa, but if it's dealing with a population that has a food shortage, then there was a prior problem that may actually be superseded. And the bioethics report, again, pointed out that it was important for those local people to make those decisions and it not be decisions from lobby groups from the West, such as Greenpeace.
Such as Monsanto.
And Greenpeace.
And I think that's true, although, you know, people like, you know, NGOs are usually helping people to function within the resources that they have, and people like Monsanto or private corporations of any kind are trying to sell them stuff that will perhaps make their lives easier and has often been shown not to make their lives easier at all.
But they are developing their own crops as well. It's not all Monsanto. In fact, Monsanto is only one of the players. Many of the GE crops are coming out of universities. They're coming from philanthropic money. They are not out to sell herbicides or pesticides, but to solve a local problem. And those are getting caught up in the same tsunami of hatred against a technology, ones that are actually being developed and produced for beneficial purposes.
Mm. I think it's this thing of, it goes back to GE and food and soil. And it's like, with all the problems that have been caused and all the issues that are still around it, why is this stuff allowed in open field trials? And why are heaps of plants, you know, why are fields planted with this stuff leading to contamination of things that are non-GE free? And I think for New Zealand, it's also a biosecurity issue. We have the opportunity to, first of all, be the point of difference. And we also have the opportunity to be GE free as an island. And I think we should really be concerned that, given the lack of testing, that these organisms come in. But having said that, I totally take your point that there are many different ways under which we're under threat from other things as well, and those need to be put in also.
And I would also say that the GE foods are the only ones that are tested. Very few of the others are tested.
Yes, but so they should be, amongst the other things that should be tested.
You know, we had a situation some years ago where a member of the Green Party, Nandor Tanzos, wanted to have widespread planting of hemp around the country, a plant that is known as a noxious weed throughout many parts of Europe. And there was no criticism of that. It was tested. It went ahead. There were field trials. Now, I would be more concerned against a vigorous noxious weed such as hemp than I would be over a BT corn, when I know that a corn can't exist in the wild. These are domesticated crops. You don't go into the bush and find groves of lettuce and groves of broccoli and groves of sweet corn.
Mm. Although there is evidence that these things cross-pollinate with things that are also there, or cross-fertilise, or whatever the word is.
But
isn't there? And the other issue is around insurance, because I think that's another big problem, that once new organisms come into the system and are accepted for release within, you know, for example, New Zealand, even underneath your, what's it called, that act?
Hazardous substances and nuisances.
Yeah.
Hazardous. I can't. Sorry, I'm not hearing my.
Oh, sorry.
Can I turn my headphones up a little?
Yeah. According to the HASNO Act.
Hazardous substances and new organisms. Yeah.
Yes. So companies, if something goes terribly wrong, they're not covered by public insurance. And so if anything goes wrong, it's going to be the public that's picking up the tab on what's gone wrong. And that's happened across across different countries as well.
So I've got a bit of an echo.
Yeah, I know, because the thing's too high. So you need to get in closer to the mic.
How's that?
And then that'll solve your problems, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
So I was involved in one of the insurance conventions about genetically modified organisms, and there was a general feeling against within the reinsurers that GMOs were a great area to be in because the perceived risk was higher than the actual risk, and that's somewhere which insurers love because it means that they can charge high premiums, but they can actually have very few payouts.
But nonetheless, they're refusing to insure crops.
They're refusing to insure crops because if a crop claims that their fields are contaminated, they're contaminated in such a way that doesn't do anybody any harm, but the public won't buy it because lobby groups have told them it will do them harm.
Mm, yes. And so, not enough is known, and people should have the choice. And that is something that, you know, a lot of the things like Federated Farmers or the seed companies are putting billions of dollars into telling people that they don't need to worry and they shouldn't have any choice. And that, for me, is fundamentally wrong. And they're aided in that by things like local government, for example, in Auckland, who doesn't want the headache of dealing with this and therefore takes out things from policy documents. And that, to me, is really wrong and should be something that we should be looking
at. What I would like to see is proper education because, you know, Greenpeace International is spending $100 million a year fighting GE, and it's doing so with misinformation. It's not doing it with rounded, balanced information. As I said, we're getting it from one extreme and the other in all of these debates, whether it's coming from Monsanto or the other lobby groups on the other side. The truth which lies in the middle is always left out. And
I think you're right. The truth often does lie in the middle. Having said that, I do wonder what have seed companies got to be so worried about. If it's so safe, then do your closed studies on it, do your longitudinal studies on it, and tell people what they're eating so they have the choice. You can't release stuff into the general environment and then when things are contaminated and things go wrong, just say, oh, well, sorry about that.
Isn't that what they're doing? They're doing many closed studies. I mean, GE crops are out there. I mean, things like BT cotton has made a phenomenal difference in the reduction of pesticides, particularly in China. BT soy has reduced pesticides in Argentina and in other parts of the world. So there are some crops that are making a massive difference on the environment. And the BT cotton in particular has been exceptionally good because it doesn't kill non-target species. It doesn't kill the lady birds, it doesn't kill the spiders, and so fields in the nearby areas are not getting spray drift, and they've also got populations, centres of land where there can be a regeneration of the predators of the pest insects. So there are clear indications that some crops are extremely good.
Oh, that's interesting, because the stuff I've read is saying that you can't control what the GE does. So, for example, the gene may not have an effect when it's modified into one thing, but if it's modified into another thing, and if it's not rats and it's pigs, and if it's not pigs it's humans, you can't determine what the effects are.
There's plenty of studies where they've shown that a lot of the ecosystem is recovering in these farms because they're no longer spraying. You know, a crop like cotton is a very dirty crop. It's sprayed very many times to get rid of the weeds. Mm. And BT cotton has been one of the big success stories.
Yeah. I think for every success, there's another five failures. But I think these are also ideological differences. So, you know, fair enough. I guess the main point I'd like to make is that if you are concerned about GMO and GMO labelling and the presence of GE in New Zealand, then you need to be making your voice heard at the Auckland Council and at national level, and particularly now at Auckland Council, because they're talking about these issues now. And there's an inter-council, do you know about this? There's an inter-council report which is being prepared as part of something that can be discussed for the unitary plan. And it's around the fact that all the policy documents for the different parts of Auckland have taken out references to GMOs and are now... And so this is looking at the process of putting those things back in. But, yes, last word from you.
I don't know what to say.
Okay, lovely. Hey, listen, thanks so much for coming in. I'm so disappointed you couldn't tell me what a nature identical flavour is. No, I'm so curious.
I can tell you what
genetic
engineering is.
Well, you'll have to look it up and tell me on Facebook, because that would be really interesting.
All right. Okay.
Hey, thanks very much for coming in and sharing your views.
Thanks for having me on,
okay.
Sherry.
Thank you. So that was David Saul, who's... I actually didn't ask you about that, because you were saying you were a forensic scientist as well as a molecular...
Molecular geneticist.
Thank you so much. Right, great. So thanks to David.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirowa.